And I actually find that to be one of the fundamental reasons why religion is so helpful to people, because it is a carefully considered way of seeing the world constructed by people who have been where we are.
Welcome, you wonderful, purposeful, and beautiful humans to Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins. Hope Still Wins is a place where we get to know thought leaders from diverse backgrounds and differing worldviews to help us feel less alone, more connected, and move us to become a better world together. Each week, I'll be interviewing inspiring and relatable guests in attempts to get to know their hearts, celebrate their stories, and explore the concept of hope to hear how and if it has played a role in their lives. Ultimately, answering the question, does hope still win? If so, why? And if not, why not? I'm so pumped for you to listen to my conversation with today's guest. This week, I have the honor of sitting down with Senior Rabbi Steve Leader of Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles, California, one of the largest synagogues in the world, and the author of multiple books, including his most recent release, The Beauty of What Remains, which we dig into in today's episode. In addition to his new book, Rabbi Leader and I talk about Judaism and what it means to be a rabbi, the real enemy of religion and faith, how death makes life beautiful and meaningful, and how grief is actually non-linear. I hope you enjoy listening to today's conversation as much as I loved having it. I hope it leaves you hopeful, and I hope it also leaves you so excited for what is to come in the ultimate goal, which is to inch closer to us becoming more unified and inspired to show us in everyday life how we are more similar than we are different. All right, it's time, my friends. Let's jump into it. On today's episode of Hope Still Wins, here's Rabbi Steve Leader. Rabbi Steve Leader, thank you so much for coming on.
It's my honor to be with you, Ben. I really appreciate it.
You're up to a lot in this world. You took some time out of your day to hang out on Hope Still Wins. Now, I want to get us started. One of the dreams of Hope Still Wins at the beginning is that we would interview people from all different backgrounds and traditions and places in this world. You're the first rabbi, I believe, that we've had on. So I want to just kick it off with, if you don't mind, explaining Judaism and then also what it means to be a rabbi.
Well, I'll try to do this quickly. You know, a rabbi of the Talmud was asked 2,000 years ago to explain Judaism in the amount of time a person could stand on one foot.
Okay.
And his explanation of all of Judaism was, while standing on one foot, don't do unto other people what is hurtful to you, and the rest is commentary. Go and study it. So essentially, Judaism is much more a set of behaviors than a creed or a single fundamental belief. These behaviors we call mitzvot, which means commandments, and Judaism is really about how to live in the world in order to make ourselves and the world better. And we have some very specific ways to do that, but if I had to just distill it down, I would say that it's ultimately about making ourselves and the world better, and through a prescribed set of behaviors. Now, what is a rabbi? So I'll tell you a quick funny story. When you're in rabbinical school, you have to go to these things we call student pulpits. And these are small towns with very few Jewish families that can't afford a full-time rabbi. So you go there one weekend a month to kind of just keep a pulse going, you know, in these places. And mine was in Sherman, Texas, which is a little town. There are about 20 Jews there, about 75 miles north of Dallas. And the first weekend I was there, they asked me to do a Sunday morning religion, AM religion on the line kind of, you know, radio show for the Christian community. So I drive up to this basically prefab tool shed with an antenna and a red light in front of it. And I go in, and this wonderful little old white haired Baptist woman welcomes me. We sit down to begin, and she starts the show with the following words: "Ladies and gentlemen, this morning we have a very special guest, Rabbi Stephen Leader, the pastor from the Hebrew Church."
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
Now, so that's about as well as I can put it for your audience. You know, I function the way all religious leaders, most religious leaders function. I will say what's a little bit different in my case is that I am the senior rabbi of what in the Christian world would be considered a mega church.
Okay.
There are very few mega synagogues, but I happen to be the senior rabbi of one of them. And so the order of magnitude is a little different than most rabbis, pastors, ministers, priests. But essentially, you know, I take care of people. I take care of their spiritual needs. I call it hatching, matching, and dispatching. And I preach and I teach and do all the business side of it too. That's incumbent upon me. I raise money and I, you know, work with a board of trustees. And I've been at the same place for 34 years, and I really love it, and I'm proud of it.
So in 34 years, was it a large synagogue when you started, or has that grown over the years?
It's grown quite a bit. When I started, we had one campus, and we now have three. And when I started, we had about 1,800 families, and we now have about 2,700 families. So we've experienced a lot of growth, which is sort of contrary to what's happening out there in synagogue and church life. So it's another thing I'm really proud of. I was just on a Zoom before this with our whole leadership team, and I truly thank them for what an incredible team they are. We have extraordinary people who work for us, and it's a team effort.
And that's, you know, kind of leads to one of my questions here. In the last 34 years leading up to today, what kind of changes stand out to you that you've seen within, you know, the synagogue and within the growth and the people involved and how they function and what their needs are? What kind of evolvement has happened?
I actually think very little has changed. And in fact, this is one of the reasons that I find Judaism so compelling, is that I don't think the world or the human condition have changed very much in 30 centuries. And that's why I think the Bible is still so relevant, and why the sages of the Talmud, which is the second great collection of Jewish literature after the Bible, which was compiled roughly 2000 years ago, there is no aspect of the human condition that our sages did not think through very, very deeply. I don't think the human condition has changed much at all. I think we suffer from the very same fears and insecurities and anxieties and pain and pleasure and challenge that our ancestors were faced with in their lives literally 3,000-4,000 years ago. So in terms of what the human need is, I don't think it's changed at all. The ways in which we're able to meet those needs now obviously are a little different. We have campuses, we have sleepaway camps, we have conference center, we have technology, you know, we have all sorts of professionals, not just the rabbis, right? We have professional educators, we have therapists, we have, you know, the way in which we address those needs or the vehicles by which we address them obviously evolve. But I don't think human beings have changed all that much. And I don't think the world has changed all that much. You know, we're not the first people to live through a plague, far from it, or floods or fires or anything else we're facing. And I actually find that to be one of the fundamental reasons why religion is so helpful to people, because it is a carefully considered way of seeing the world constructed by people who have been where we are.
The my hope is that one day Hope Still Wins will have a very diverse audience of people, listening, learning, talking to each other. But the truth is right now, a lot of the audience is majority Christian, based on kind of my past and my current profession. How do you, you know, with having such an important and large synagogue on the West Coast, how do you interact with Christians, or how do Christians interact with you? Because basically what you said at the beginning is, you know, Judaism is a desire to be better people and create a better world. So within that, how do you work alongside, or how does that relationship look from your perspective?
Well, I have two parallel sets of relationships. I have my personal relationships and the relationships that have grown out of my work as a writer, out of my books, which are universal. What I have done mostly with my writing is taken these very particular Jewish concepts and universalized them. And let's remember that the New Testament or the Christian Bible includes the Hebrew Bible, right? It's rooted in Judaism. In fact, Christianity and Islam are both deeply rooted and nourished by the soil of Judaism. So we have far more in common than we do what separates us. And so we speak the same language. And I have worked very hard at getting these books out into the Christian community, in the evangelical community, in the African-American community, and have had real success with it, because we're all really, really marching in the same direction in the most fundamental ways when it comes to understanding the human condition. And to bring about a better day. You know, for Christians, it's the second coming. For Jews, it's the first. But really, what's the difference as long as it arrives, right? So I have these really amazing relationships with the larger Christian community. I've spoken at the NRB and at a number of mega churches, and Rick Warren and I are buddies. And, you know, I have those personal relationships. Then institutionally, we have sister churches. You know, we're part of an interreligious council. We're part of an interfaith community. We have the largest Jewish Muslim gathering every year in Los Angeles of any during the year. When we end iftar with the Islamic Center of Southern California. So, and one of our campuses, and I think this is important if you know Los Angeles, one of our campuses is in a neighborhood called Koreatown. I mean, we are in that happens to be the most ethnically diverse council district in America, west of Brooklyn. There are 60 languages spoken within a 5-mile radius of our urban campus. And so we are definitionally a part of the world. And I spend many Sundays speaking at churches, and I invite others to speak at the synagogue, and we work together. We run a network of food pantries with our neighbors and all of those things. So there are these two parallel sets of relationships. And to be honest, I don't think we can ever do enough of that. It can never be enough. And, you know, I applaud your goal to create a format here and a platform for people of faith, of different faiths, to come together around the common denominators. That's important.
So would you say your hope in these efforts to bring people together of all different faiths, for you specifically, is the hope to do more for humanity? Is the hope to continue to grow Judaism? Like when you
yeah.
start working alongside these relationships, what dreams do you have for these people to be working together? And then my follow-up to that would be, what's stopping us now? Like what are you seeing that's kind of holding everybody back?
Well, I have a dream for more and a dream for less. I have a dream for more understanding, more empathy, more respect, more cooperation, and an ever deeper realization that we're all brothers and sisters. Those are my goals for the more. I also have goals for less. I do this work because I want to see less territorialism. I want to see less narcissism. I want to see less certitude of our own position. I want to see less of, in order for me to be right, you have to be wrong. I want to see less bickering. And I want to see less of the foolish critiques of what religion is for the world. You know, it's such an easy thing to take a pot shot at religion, and it's incredibly unfair in most cases. And we need to make the positive case for a spiritual religious life.
How do we do that, Rabbi Steve? See, we're getting more informal now, Rabbi Steve. How do we do that? Like, how do we, what things, and we're going to get into your book here in a second, and you've came out with some great work, and recently you just came out with a new book in January that we're going to talk about, but I want to know, as you look at this world and you see people having a hard time getting to this place and this point, because of, you know, I maybe in my lack of knowledge, I blame it on biases. I believe it on comfort, a little protection, like, you know, and the fear of if I'm wrong and they're right, then this whole thing's been a joke. Like, so how do we work through these issues as humans to get to a place where we are working together for a common good?
Well, those are two different questions. I think the question about how do we grow people religiously and spiritually is, I think, first of all, we have to make the case, a positive case, right? Why is it better for the world? You know, if you were walking down a dark alley and saw two people coming at you, you'd feel a little different about it if you saw one of them was carrying a Bible and you knew they were coming home from Bible study, right? There's a lot of positive things we know about religion. You know, people say, oh, religion is the cause of all, you know, all this strife and war. Well, think about the three most murderous regimes of the 20th century. Mao in China, Stalin in the Soviet Union, and Hitler in Germany. Those were the three regimes that outlawed religion. They're not the regimes that embraced it. They're the regimes that outlawed it. You know, and people say to me, well, you know, I don't believe in organized religion, to which I say, well, what would you prefer? Disorganized religion? Your phone call doesn't get returned when you call? The rabbi doesn't show up on time or answer an email? Or what does that mean, organized religion, right? And so I think we need to make the positive case for Christianity, for Judaism and Islam as a way of life, because the real enemy is not religion. The real enemy is fanaticism. A fanatic secularist is as dangerous as a fanatic Jew, a fanatic Christian, or a fanatic Muslim. The danger we face, Ben, is fanaticism, not religion. Okay? And I think we just need to keep making the case. And now this is going to make me unpopular with some of my colleagues. Maybe you'll agree with me, maybe you won't. But I think the real enemy of religion, particularly in America, is boredom. It's the fact that when most people go to church or synagogue or the mosque, the person in front representing the faith and the tradition has nothing to say. The quality of our clergy, and I know I sound like an arrogant jerk right now, but we're having a real conversation.
Yeah.
Okay. I taught in the seminary here for 13 years. The real enemy of faith is boredom.
That's so interesting. I never thought about that. I was going to turn the corner here for a second, but I do want to lean into that a little bit. Could you mind expounding a little bit more on what you mean by boredom?
Sure. You go to synagogue, you go to church, you go to the mosque, and you hear someone up there regurgitating the news, treating you like you can't read the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and watch CNN and Fox all by yourself. Not talking about God, not talking about wisdom, not talking about the life of the spirit, right? Because they're afraid to, or they don't have the spiritual depth themselves to do it. You know, in trying to entertain, you know, often socially awkward, often talking about your life when you know full well they know nothing about your life. And I think this is a particularly difficult problem in Catholicism and in certain streams of all religions. And I'm not, I don't mean to disparage all clergy, but let's be honest, okay? I like to spin, okay? I go to spin class, I look around, the music's better, I feel better when I'm done. The people are like in better shape, and I don't just mean physically, mentally, right? It takes 40 minutes. And I think to myself, this is church for people. This is church, okay? We have to compete. We have to give people real nutrients. You know, I feel like when most people go to church or synagogue, they're given a picture of food to eat. They're not given the real thing. And that creates boredom, and they don't come back, and I don't blame them. And so, you know, there's this old Yiddish saying that a fish rots from the head, meaning if an organization is sort of corrupt and inept or whatever it is, you should look at the leadership. Well, if that's true, then the opposite must also be true. That if we can have great, if we can do a better job of recruiting and training spiritual leaders in this country, we will have more people embracing faith. It's difficult, of course, because, you know, I don't know how old you are. How old are you, by the way?
32.
Okay, so I have a 32-year-old son, okay? Your age. He and his friends, they don't want to run synagogues or churches. They want to make movies. They want to run hedge funds. You know, they want to develop real estate. They don't want to work weekends. So there are challenges, but we have to overcome them, because if we don't have great spiritual leaders, we won't last as a spiritual community.
This week's episode of Hope Still Wins is brought to you by Generous International. Generous International is a company that I co-founded. Generous donates 100% of profits to nonprofits fighting human-facing injustice. So every bag of coffee bought, every cup of coffee drink is going back to make the world a better place. Generous is best known for selling coffee, specialty grade coffee. So it's some of the best coffee in the world. You're going to drink coffee anyways, and like we like to say, why not make it life-changing coffee? Well, you can visit Generous at generouscoffee.com. Please go out today and check out Generous Coffee. I just got back from a pastor speaking conference gathering, I guess they called it, about a week and a half ago. And one of the topics was the lack of movement inside of church. And it talked about how there's injustice out there, and we stand and we sing songs, and then nothing gets done on the outside. There's no momentum, there's no movement, there's nothing that, you know, young people are seeing and recognizing. When I'm talking the Christian church here, like a lot of people aren't recognizing it as a place to fight injustice and to bring about something good. And so they just say, what's the point? Like, why would I show up for an hour,
right,
and then come home and, like, you know, right, that's my Sunday.
Right. So I'll tell you what we did at our downtown, at our urban campus. We have a beautiful sanctuary on the south side of the campus. On the north side of the campus, we built a social services center for our neighbors, our needy neighbors. I said to the board, we should not be pretending our neighbors aren't poor. They are. So we actually built, paid for, and operate completely on our own a social services center where we provide free dental care, free vision care, free food security, free mental health services, and free legal aid services in Korean, Spanish, and English. all for free. We've trained 600 volunteers from the congregation, and we have 4 paid professional staff. So from my point of view, whether you walk onto our campus through the sanctuary doors on the south or the social service center doors on the north makes no difference to me. Just come on in.
Well, to transition here just a bit, and thank you for sharing all that. I think it's incredibly interesting, and I hope it's invigorating, inspiring for the people listening to go, hey, maybe my local area, however I worship, maybe there's some people out there, if I look left and right, that could use some care, some love, some attention. Maybe that's an answer to a lot of the problems, maybe if they're asking themselves, especially in the local communities, the smaller places of worship. You came out with a book in January, and I want to talk about it because it's a really beautiful, and it hits deep for me. I believe it also hits very personal to you, at least from my understanding. The book's called The Beauty of What Remains. You have many books, and I'll mention them at the end of the podcast here. But this one came out in January. It comes from a personal experience of yours. Do you mind explaining what that personal experience is?
Yeah. So the book, The Beauty of What Remains, is 2 stories woven together into one. The first is the story of my father's 10-year journey through Alzheimer's and his death. And my journey through that, a journey in which I moved from Steve Leader, the rabbi, to Steve Leader, the son. And the book is about everything I thought I knew as Steve Leader, the rabbi, that when I was Steve Leader, the son, I realized was wrong. You know, before my father died, I had literally helped 1,000 families with death. I had officiated over 1,000 funerals, seen over 1,000 dead bodies. And I thought I knew something about death and loss and grief. And then my father died. And I wasn't the rabbi, I was the son. And I realized how little I actually knew before about loss. And so part of the book is that journey and those corrections, that resetting of ideas about memory, about grief, about what's important, really important in life, about the fact that it's who we have, not what we have, that makes life meaningful, about the fact that death itself makes life meaningful. You know, Kafka said the meaning of life is that it ends, and it's true. It wasn't, even though I had seen 1,000 dead bodies then, I'd stood next to 1,000 families and watched them look at their loved one in the casket. To be honest with you, it didn't affect me very much. I could have eaten a sandwich, really. I mean, it was my job. Not that I lack empathy, but it wasn't my loved one. Then, when I bent over my father's casket and looked into that casket, and we look almost identical, it was the first time at 58 years old, even after 1,000 funerals, it was the first time I realized I am going to die, and my son is going to be bent over my casket. Now, what am I going to do with my life? And so the book is about the ways in which death is a powerful teacher of life. Now, that's the essence, but it is also, therefore, a book that is a kind of field guide to grief. Where am I in this process? What should I do? What should I not do? What do I say? What do I not say to people who are grieving? What plans should I make? What plans should I not make? How do I know when it's time to pull the plug, when it's not time to pull the plug? It's both of these things. It's this personal journey and the reassessment of so many aspects of death and therefore life, coupled with really pragmatic help for people who are going through hell. And as I often say to people, if you have to go through hell, don't come out empty-handed. And this book is intended to help us all not come out of that hell empty-handed, but to come out of that hell in a way that helps us appreciate all the beauty that remains in life.
If you're going to go through hell, don't come out empty-handed. Wow. That's it also, you know, from my perspective, is a book that helps people feel less alone in these moments of despair and confusion. And so to kind of close up here, I do want to ask you, and again, it's Steve Leader. He's the senior rabbi at Wilshire Boulevard Temple in Los Angeles. How have you seen the confrontation with death and grief change your life and your perspective to build this deeper relationship with breath and the world?
Yeah, yeah. I would say three things, and I'll try to do it quickly. First, I was raised, I'm 61, I was raised under the teaching of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross about death and grief, that it's that there are stages to it, and I discovered that's completely untrue, that grief is non-linear. Grief is much more like waves. They come very close together at first, then they spread out, and you can have beautiful calm seas for a month, a year, a decade even, and sometimes, nevertheless, like a huge rogue wave can rise up and just crash down on you. That grief is non-linear, okay? And that when the waves come, the best thing to do is just lie down and let it wash over you and float with it. That's the first thing, that grief is non-linear. The second thing I learned about is the duality of memory. You know, pastors, rabbis, ministers, imams, we have all these cliches about memory. May his memory be a blessing. She'll live on in your memories, right? And that's all true. Memory is beautiful, but it also really, really hurts sometimes. There's a duality to memory that we have to make peace with in order to live and remember and go forward. That's the second thing. And the third thing, I really seems so obvious, but sometimes it takes death to really wake us up. And the third thing I would say, the major reassessment was that I would say, no matter how many times we say, I love you, and no matter how many times we hold and are held by the people we love, it's never enough. Do it more, say it more, be it more.
Rabbi Steve, I really appreciate you coming on today. And again, Rabbi Steve Leader is the author of a recent book, The Beauty of What Remains. He's also the author of The Extraordinary Nature of Ordinary Things and More Money Than God, Living a Rich Life Without Losing Your Soul. Rabbi Steve Leader, we ask everybody the same question when they come on this podcast. It matches the title of the show, and it's one that I'm super interested to hear your thoughts on. Answer it however you like. Take as much time as you need. Rabbi Steve, do you believe that hope still wins? If so, why? And if not, why not?
I don't just believe it. I know it. You know, the anthem, by the way, of the Jewish people in the state of Israel is Hatikva, which means the hope. I know that the day begins at midnight, the darkest moment of the day. I know that we see light through our pupil, the darkest part of our eye. I know that when we walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I know that a shadow, no matter how long or how dark, is proof of light. You can't have a shadow unless a light is still shining. It's obstructed by something, but it's still shining. You know, the rabbis of the Talmud, there's a blessing Jews say over the new moon, because we have a lunar calendar. Even a blind person is required to say the blessing over the new moon. In other words, we have to affirm what we cannot even see sometimes. And I know that the sun rises no matter how long or how dark the night. And therefore, I have complete and total faith that hope ultimately wins. I'll tell you a beautiful story about this. And maybe we'll close with this. It's a story about a religious father and his son who were in Auschwitz together during the Holocaust. And it was the festival of Hanukkah, the festival of lights. And the father tore off a little piece of his uniform and stuck it into his daily tiny pad of butter, his daily ration of butter. They gave people about 400 calories a day, and it was mostly just a crust of bread and some butter, moldy bread and butter. And he took that little wick that he made out of his uniform and stuck it into the pad of butter and was about to light it on fire as the closest thing he could do to lighting Hanukkah candles. And his son said to him, "Papa, don't you need the calories? Shouldn't you save the butter for your bread? I mean, God will understand." And the father says to his son, "I can live a single day without butter. I cannot live a single day without hope."
Rabbi Steve, thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. Thank you for writing your books. I appreciate you coming on Hope Still Wins. The listeners do as well. Again, it's Rabbi Steve Leader with Hope Still Wins today. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ben. I was honored to be with you today.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode of Hope Still Wins. If you haven't already, please subscribe or follow the show wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoyed this conversation, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple and join the community over on Instagram at Hope Still Wins. That is it for today, my friends. I highly encourage you to pick up a copy of Rabbi Leader's book, The Beauty of What Remains, anywhere books are sold. Thanks again for listening to today's episode of Hope Still Wins. I'm your host, Ben Higgins, and I'll talk to you next week.